You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Matt.
Hi, Bob. Great to see you.
Good to see you. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, editor-in-chief of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Matthew Duss, the executive vice president at the Center for International Policy, and formerly a foreign policy advisor to Bernie Sanders, and some other things. And we're going to talk about, well, international relations, foreign policy, various things. Yeah. Just quickly, so I guess you would call the Center for International Policy an anti-blob think tank, or is that going too far, man?
I mean, that we wouldn't dispute that. You know, a progressive foreign policy think tank. That often puts us at odds with the conventional wisdom, the blob, so-called.
The blob.
So, yes.
Okay. And so, like, how many anti-blob think tanks? So Quincy is like a left-right coalition anti-blob think tank. I guess you could, I mean, Cato isn't mainly foreign policy, but it has a foreign policy arm, and I guess you would call that kind of anti-blob.
Right. No, I think they've been doing good work in that space for a long time. You know, I'd say some of the work that Chris Preble, formerly of Cato, and and Emma Ashford are doing now at Stimson, even though I wouldn't put
Chris is at Stimson.
Yeah, they're at Stimson doing some really good stuff. But no, I think people who take a more critical view, I mean, these ideas have filtered out. You know, you have Stephen Wertheim, who was one of the founders originally of Quincy, who's now at Carnegie. You've got the statecraft program there where I sat for a year after leaving the Hill, which is, you know, doing some critical thinking about some of the ideas that have gotten the country in so much trouble over the past few decades. So there is a good proliferation of some of this stuff.
So there's hope. Enough hope. Let's move to the real world.
On a high note.
Yeah, that was fun while it lasted.
Yeah.
The upbeatness of it. So let's start in the Middle East, where today, I gather, Israel announces calling up 10,000 troops as part of, let's call it an initiative in Gaza. Not that there weren't already initiatives going on there. One official told the Wall Street Journal that their plan was to, quote, conquer the Gaza Strip and occupy it. I gather the official plan is to, for starters, carve out more space in the north, push more civilians to the south, so that if anyone is left, they can call them militants and wipe out their infrastructure and them, I guess. Is that what they're saying they're going to do?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't looked in great detail. I mean, I've seen some of the, just briefly, some of the coverage. But yes, they are talking about, I think, you know, forcing some 2 million inhabitants into a quarter of the Gaza Strip's territory, with the theory being that, yes, and then they will go in and, you know, quote unquote, mop up the remaining members of Hamas. But this is all just complete bullshit. I mean, because Netanyahu, from the beginning, the goal, whatever he says, the goal for Netanyahu is to just prolong the war under whatever pretext. You know, as others have noted, there are more now more Hamas members in Gaza than there were when the war started. Because this tends to happen when you flatten entire cities, when you like inflict pain on a population, which is one of the goals of this Gaza war, has been to inflict suffering on the people of Gaza, whether or not they are members of Hamas. You tend to produce resistance, and that results in more people wanting to join organizations that fight back. And Hamas is one of those options, unfortunately. So, yeah, I mean, whatever the Israelis say their actual goal is, for Netanyahu, the goal has been purely political.
So to stay in power, the idea being that, first of all, it's a distraction from various things that a lot of Israelis hate about him, but also he needs to appease the far right of his coalition to stay in power, and they want this to happen.
That's true. I mean, and he knows, you know, once this war ends, and this has been true since very, very early on, once the war ends and a real reckoning takes place, once people like have a moment to breathe and look at the massive failures, including his failure, that allowed the attack to happen, he understands that that will be the end of his political career, and he's frantically trying to avoid that from happening.
So do you think he has any end game at all in mind strategically? I mean, he is, he has an ideology. He's not a sheer careerist politician, right? I mean, he, there's a legacy he would like to have, I guess. Do you think he has any long-term plan?
You know, he's, you know, his ideology is just that all this land belongs to Israel.
That's and, what I
and,
mean.
You know, and Israeli Jews, as you know, not and not Israeli Palestinians. Obviously, they may be allowed to live in this land if they behave as kind of second class citizens. But ultimately, you know, you can make a good argument. I think a correct argument that, you know, his policies have been disastrous for the state of Israel. So clearly he's someone who kind of defines Israel's security and well-being as inextricable from his own political well-being. That's where we are.
Yeah. Do you think the Biden administration would be doing anything more than the Trump is doing to, constrain this, which is zero, I gather?
Yeah. Oh, sure. We'd see lots more statements of concern. We see a lot more statements about how we're seeking clarity. So we'd see more performative, you know, kind of statements of, you know, and leaks of how the president is really upset this time. He really put it to Netanyahu on the phone call. But no, in practical terms, I mean, the policy would be, you know, and you might see little pressing at kind of lower and mid levels at state and Pentagon to say, we do need a few more trucks going in, of aid. And the Israelis would probably relent and allow a few more trucks of aid. And then these officials would pat themselves on the back and feel that they've done a good day's work. But no, as a practical matter, the policy would be very, very similar.
Do you think that's ever going to change? I mean, polls do show American opinion changing. You probably saw this poll a couple of weeks ago that showed, first of all, a clear majority of Americans had an unfavorable view of Israel. Mm-hmm. Then there was a breakdown. I forget whether it was conservative, liberal, or Democrat, Republican, but either way, on the right, a majority of people under 40, I forget whether it was Republicans or conservatives, but a clear majority of people under 40 mm-hmm. had an unfavorable view of Israel.
Yeah, I can't imagine why that is, you know.
I mean, that is, I mean, it. Netanyahu's goal does sometimes seem to be to get as much of the world as possible to hate him. Right. If that's, to hate Israel. But my question is kind of, you know, notwithstanding that, that's the lay of the land in public opinion. Most Americans have a negative view. Doesn't seem to affect policy. As you've just said, it wouldn't matter whether a Republican was in power or a Democrat right now. What Bibi's doing, which really, I mean, we should pause and reflect on this. By historical standards, I mean, there have been a lot of things that have happened over there that people have complained about that Israel did, but this is just about unprecedented. The last, and there's like not a murmur that matters, you know?
And here I would, and I think, I mean, there's two things. One is, yes, you're right. Given, you know, you've seen these polls and this polls, the survey you mentioned is only the latest in years of trending this way. And we can talk about why it has been trending that way. But and then the question is, OK, given that views of Americans and particularly of Democrats have become much, much more critical of Israeli policy. And I do want to clarify, we're talking about Israeli policy, although, as you said, I mean, in that particular survey was views of Israel in general. Mm-hmm. Why are they so slow to be reflected amongst our elected leaders? You know, part of it is, and we can talk about how, you know, do people might express these views to pollsters, but how much do they care? You know, that's the intensity question in these kinds of polls. Okay, you've expressed this view about a foreign policy issue. Where do you place foreign policy in the priority, you know, on your agenda personally that you're going to decide to vote or not vote for a particular candidate or party? And in those cases, I mean, the number of people who really prioritize these issues is not high. But also the problem here, and this is a problem that is in some ways particular to Biden, is that he was not just bad on Israel. He was bad on Israel in a way that is like of a very old school, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think it's deeply ideological with him. This idea that there must be no daylight. This is something he said literally for decades. And this is kind of the rule that he laid down in his administration's approach. And now when you have a president who is the leader of a party governing in this way, you know, members of a political party, whether Republicans or Democrats, you know, tend to not like to go against presidents of their own parties. Now, that's not a defense. I think that's a problem. I think, you know, especially for something like this, as you noted, this was not a normal catastrophe. I mean, this was something that, you know, Israel, they were proclaiming literally publicly what they were going to do. And then they did it. And the Biden administration spent about a year and a half pretending that they weren't actually seeing what was going on. It was not just a moral and strategic failure in continuing to fund and arm this. It was an ethical failure in that they basically waged a disinformation campaign in support of the war as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we should say, because some people are thinking it now, that Israel would reply, well, October 7th was unprecedented in its own way, and so you get an unprecedented response. It's just that it seems that the response went not only so far beyond what was necessary to ensure Israel's security, mm-hmm. but arguably kept going far enough to, in subtle ways, imperil Israel's long-term mm-hmm. position in the world.
Yeah.
And in ways that mainly did serve Bibi Netanyahu's political interests.
Right. And Biden himself, if you remember, like when Biden like came out with his ceasefire proposal almost exactly a year ago, he said that the goal of preventing another October 7th has been achieved. Mm-hmm. I would argue, and I think many Israeli security analysts would argue, that was achieved within weeks, if not days, of October 7, when you understand all mm-hmm. the failures and oversights that led, you know, that enabled those attacks to happen. But still, the president of the United States said that. And so what were they actually doing, for the last year? They were simply pummeling Gaza and punishing its population.
Yeah. And, you know, if people ask, what business is it of ours? I mean, it is our tax dollars. We are paying for the weapons. Americans are.
I would just add, we're not just paying for the weapons, and we are paying in terms of diplomatic time and energy and political time and energy and intelligence support, the amount of support.
Well, and in terms of our standing in the world. And I would say in terms of our security. I mean, I don't know how much it increases the chances of a domestic terrorist attack, but the fact is that some of the past so-called homegrown terrorist incidents and were explicitly in retaliation for things we did in the Middle East. It wasn't Israel-Palestine so much usually. It was more like bombing, you know, Afghanistan or whoever we were bombing, Iraq, whatever. But the point is blowback can happen. There's no upside here for us security-wise. I mean, there are things people will say like, I forget what they are, but anyway, there are things people will say that are good for us security wise, like, you know, Iran is a grave threat to us. And so even if you accept that premise, I really don't know what good this is doing right now. But it's kind of bleak. And, it's funny. I had Tom Friedman on. It was probably 5 or 6 months after October 7th. And we were saying, like, okay, clearly, look, Israel, they've made the point, you know, the ratio of, is up to 20 to 1 or whatever of Palestinians dead to Israelis mm-hmm. dead in this last exchange, and so on. And I said, well, maybe once they kill Sinwar, you know, Bibi can declare victory. Then it would be easy to say we won and just pull out. Yeah. And Tom said, well, they may also want to get this guy, Mohammed, what is it, Dow, for some of the military commander?
Yeah.
Well, they killed them both.
Yeah.
And it just, it just keeps going.
Yeah.
And anyway, I don't know. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah, and and again, this is where I want to come back. You know, listen, Netanyahu is going to be Netanyahu. But this is where I think we really have to kind of acknowledge the failure of Biden and his team here, because they are the ones who essentially kept pretending that this was all normal. And, you know, even if they didn't, even if the Israelis were overreacting a little bit and this one attack, they had a problem and they were seeking clarification and they were pushing back here and there. In general, they never gave any signal that they that what was happening here was not basically within the boundaries of reasonable self-defense. And it is not. It is absolutely not. And this is where, and I've written, and I will, you know, that, you know, I think the Biden administration actually did more damage to the so-called rules-based order with its Gaza policy than anything we saw so far from Trump. Now, Trump may do more. I mean, he seems to be intent on tearing down this order in his own way. But I think when you combine the Gaza policy, especially coming right after, you know, their approach to Ukraine, in which they, you know, proclaimed a whole set of principles and rules and norms and condemned Russia repeatedly, in my view, rightly, for violating, and then showed the entire world that, oh, that support for those rules is conditional. When our friends are doing it, we're going to take a completely different approach. And that, I mean, let's say the rest of the world, especially the developing world, the global South, whatever word we want to use, has always been aware of these hypocrisies. But you could not have designed a more effective social science experiment to lay bare that hypocrisy than Ukraine and Gaza side by side.
Yeah, the and, you know, Israel, I mean, at the moment, it's engaged. I mean, it's bombing Syria. It's bombing Lebanon. They say they're going to soon start bombing the Houthis. I mean, they're really feeling their oats. And the irony is, you know, they succeeded beyond their wildest expectations in weakening the very, you know, their various adversaries, and basically stripped Iran of its deterrent capacity fairly effectively, I would say, in terms of what they did with, I mean, in terms of the current status of Hezbollah, the fact that Israel can no longer get arms to Lebanon through Syria, and the fact that I think, I mean, that Iran can't, and that, and I think Iran's ballistic missiles were shown to be a not very efficient deterrent in those exchanges. So I don't really, now tell me, you know, I mean, to get back to the Biden administration, you know, these guys, you know, Blinken and Sullivan, do you have any insight into what was happening? Was it just the, you know, Joe Biden brooks no dissent and it was all him or what?
You know, I won't say that I know them more than I do. I know them both a little bit. I think I would look at two things. One is Blinken has been a staffer for Biden for a very, very long time. And that's the thing to keep in mind is like both of these guys were staffers, right? And that is, I'm not the first one to observe this. Others have observed this as well. A part of the challenge on foreign policy is that Biden had few, if any, people who he actually considered peers who could kind of walk in and say, you're screwing this up, Mr. President. You need to take a different approach. But, you know, Blinken and Biden, as far as I could tell, were very much of similar minds. That's not not rare for a staffer who's worked with a boss for, you know, over 20 years. You know, and Sullivan worked for him in the Obama administration. I believe he was his national security advisor. So, again, they have a history here. But I don't want to absolve them. I mean, clearly, Biden, this is an issue on which the issue of U.S.-Israel relationship is one in which Biden was more deeply ideologically committed, I think, probably than most, if any, other issue. He's been that way for a long time, and others have written about that. And, you know, what happens sometimes when you have a boss who has kind of laid down the lines of like, I'm not going to do this. These are the kind of boundaries within which I'm willing to work. You know, staffers tend to stop offering suggestions that lie outside those boundaries. And I think that's part of what happened here. But the bottom line is they went along with it. So we should not, must not absolve either of them for their role in this catastrophe.
Yeah, you can't always resign if you want. That's
true. I mean, no one was forcing them to stay there.
And that's also the only way to see if you actually have any leverage with a very forceful boss is to go in and say, I'm going to resign. And see what they do.
As I noted today, there's nothing stopping them from speaking up now. as Israel has now explicitly announced its policy of ethnic cleansing. There's, you know, nothing other than a lame, you know, commitment to, you know, the norms that would prevent them from speaking out now. And they are choosing not to.
Well, I think it would be a little awkward given how close the ethnic cleansing was to being explicit while they were still in office and not resigning.
No, that's right. But, you know, so that's what I'm saying. I mean, they are centrally supportive of it. That's the only conclusion one can come to.
So do you see any hope? I want to get to other issues and kind of what the progressive line should be. I know you wrote a piece about Trump's tariffs and how inadequate they are as an adjustment to global economic realities. I want to talk about all that stuff, but quickly, do you see great hope in the, you know, in the array of likely Democratic presidential candidates? I don't know. Who knows? Maybe your boss Bernie is up for another run. But how old is he now?
Oh, I think he's 83. I do not think he will be running again. I think again, you know, no one can say for sure, but you know, I think he's clearly out there trying to just keep the issues that he's always focused on the agenda, and I think he's doing a pretty damn good job of it.
By the way, I think he, more than any other plausible candidate, more than anyone who could have wound up being president, would have taken a very different line here.
Oh, absolutely.
In the Middle East.
No question.
Okay, so anyway, no particular, I've been kind of touting for a while, well, partly just as a candidate who I think could win, a candidate who I think could have beaten Trump this time around, Chris Murphy, and also as a candidate who, you know, as people who can plausibly wind up being president go, it's foreign policy, you know, there's worse in the Democratic Party.
I like Murphy a lot. You know, I think, you know, I got a chance to know, I've known him since, you know, before I started working for Bernie. You know, he's kind of distinguished himself as a foreign policy voice on the Democratic side. But just over the past couple of years, he really has kind of articulated a bigger theory of the case in terms of a new political consensus. He's really leaned into kind of the anti-corruption piece of it, which I think is really, really important. He's also been open to, you know, he said a number of things and been criticized about, you know, having a big tent with social conservatives. And again, one gets into trouble like that on the Democratic side. But if we are serious about, you know, protecting democracy, we really do need to have a conversation about what are our red lines, you know, you know, what are the issues that we define as litmus tests, and what are the issues we can agree to disagree on as we kind of, you know, again, just defend the basic democratic compact and hopefully, you know, work to define a new shared understanding of the American political project, because I think that is what's at stake right now. That's, people talk about polarization, and I think it's true. You know, polarization is a consequence of a dysfunctional government, a corrupt political system, but a lot of people have just lost a shared sense of what America's really actually all about.
Mm-hmm. And so your take on the tariffs, you know, the policy is supposedly a form of, you know, populism, a way to pay attention to the working men and women of America. But I gather it's not exactly what you would have ordered.
No, I mean, as you know, so this piece that my colleague Trevor Sutton and I wrote a few weeks ago in Foreign Policy Magazine, making this case like, yes, you know, it's good that we've kind of moved away from this old neoliberal economic theology that saw free trade, unfettered, unrestricted free trade as like the ultimate good. And I do use that word theology intentionally because it was basically, here's a set of economic assumptions that must not be questioned. It turns out we should have been questioning them all along, and a lot of people have been questioning them. But now that memo has really landed, you know, just understanding that tariffs are a tool in a government's toolbox like others, let's try and use them wisely when we have to use them. Trump is not using them wisely, I'd say. He's more using them as kind of a tool of extortion, a tool of generating kind of personal fealty. But, you know, as we wrote, you know, the some level of creative destruction is long overdue, not just in economic policy, in foreign policy as well. But our piece was more focused on economic policy. But let's think about what we're actually trying to do. If we want to, you know, the problem with neoliberalism is that it basically constrained governments from, you know, fully addressing the impacts of you know, imbalanced trade. It restrained governments, like, you know, organizations like the WTO and agreements like that, forbade governments from taking certain steps to protect their own population from the negative impacts of the trade policies. And that's the problem. Trump seems to be taking some of the worst aspects of the old order and combining them with the worst aspects of an even older order, where you have like the sovereign, the monarch, or whomever using trade policy for his or her own personal benefit.
Yeah. The, you know, the irony is, from my point of view, I mean, as you know, I'm a big fan of, well, something that hasn't happened much, but actually using trade agreements as a way to further aims on both the labor and environmental front. There's been a little of those in regional trade blocks, pretty much nothing at the level of the WTO. But the irony is Trump, during his first term, did something really innovative when he renegotiated NAFTA and, of course, rebranded it, which was it was something about how, like, automobiles to qualify for free trade within the three countries, some percentage of their parts had to be built at factories with a minimum wage of, I think, $16 or something. And, you know, whether it would have had much effect, I don't know. But the point is, as an idea, you know, as something that, like, kind of puts a de facto floor on the average wage level in an industry like in Mexico. And it was favored by Mexico's labor unions, by America's labor unions, and in principle, a trade agreement can be a place where workers of the world unite. And this was actually, I think, a kind of a novel wrinkle. I mean, there had been, in the original NAFTA, there had been things about, I don't know, respecting the right to organize organize unions or something, but it was all pretty weak tea. Whereas things like this, you know, I mean, in principle, you could have a North American minimum wage, and this would be a step toward something like that. I mean, Trump, I don't know if he was even aware that it was there the first time. I don't know who's actually responsible for it. If he was, he's probably forgotten it. But you know, traditionally, when you say things like this, people have said, well, hey, just get real. OK, I mean, the industrialists, whoever, they're never going to put up with that. But what I would say is, if you show them the last couple of months and say, well, if you don't do anything to address the impact of global trade on various different constituencies, you can wind up with a president like this doing shit like this. Which would you rather have? They'd be like, $16 an hour. Where is it? You know, bring it on. And so I would like to revive discussion of that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay. Yeah. I'm counting on you to do it.
Yeah. Amanda, let me just make a note here.
Okay. Yeah. Could you write that down?
But yeah, I mean, as you know, I mean, there are a number of things and there are ideas out there. That's a good one, on steps that could be taken to actually benefit workers, if that was the real goal here, instead of just kind of using a populist pitch to the working class to achieve another set of goals. Namely the dismantling of the administrative state. And I think that is where, you know, Trump is in line with a very, very longstanding project of the American right, which is this idea that true liberty, requires protecting wealth from democracy, you know. And this is where there is a lot of consonance with the old neoliberal trade theology, because kind of one of the principles that underlied that was like, this stuff is so important, we need to find ways to inoculate it or protect it or cordon it off from actual democratic decision making. So I think that's where you see these two things aligned.
Yeah. So I guess trade naturally brings up the subject of China. This is probably a subject that, well, I would have said traditionally that it divides kind of elites in both parties. But it seems to me there's more and more of a kind of a China hawk consensus, or at least I may be sensing a little bit of a backlash at the elite level, just in terms of dissent from the consensus. But what is your view on where progressives should be on China? I mean, it's a big subject with a lot of dimensions, but...
Yeah, I mean, it'll be no surprise that I'll just refer to a piece that Senator Sanders wrote in Foreign Affairs. It was April 2021, kind of pushing back on the new this new fast-forming China Cold War. And again, the Cold War analogy is an imperfect one, as all analogies are. The U.S. and China are far more deeply intertwined economically and in other ways than the U.S. and the Soviet Union ever were. But still, it's just this idea that we are in this ongoing, probably decades-long conflict, competition, whatever term one wants to use, between the United States and China. And that is kind of, you know, the focusing instrument, the lens through which all of our foreign policy conversations must now take place. And you're right, we've seen that. It's been pretty impressive and slash scary how fast that has become Washington's kind of focusing obsession for foreign policy. But I would say, you know, I would refer to that piece. And just to lay it out, it's first to recognize, you know, yes, China has been doing a lot of things like internally and externally that should concern us. I mean, its treatment of the Uyghurs, its general repressive, you know, surveillance state is something that progressives don't like, that I don't like. But the idea that we are locked into this conflict, then that should define the relationship. I think that is inevitably going to lead to conflict. I mean, we should start from a place, okay, what do we need to do to advance America's security and prosperity and freedom? What should a U.S.-China relationship look like that advances those things? Recognizing that China is not going anywhere, we do need to find a way to kind of coexist. And let's, how do we have kind of a relationship and a policy that confronts, you know, some of China's bad behavior when it has to, that doesn't kind of tee up a zero-sum conflict, a zero-sum competition, or a zero-sum relationship. And I know that you'll love this. Because that is something that's, A, going to inevitably empower authoritarian, hawkish, hardline voices in both countries. That always is the case. But, you know, pitting the interests of American workers against Chinese workers is also something that is not going to benefit workers in either country.
I actually agree that, first of all, you know, I mean, nothing is more conducive to authoritarian in your own country than kind of a wartime footing or even a great sense of impending conflict or deep inherent tension. And that's why it's kind of ironic that one of the things feeding the China hawkism is fear that China is going to somehow export their authoritarianism here if we engage with China. And I have not seen any good evidence that that's even on their list of to-do items. I think to some extent it's projection. We have always been very intent on exporting our ideology, and I like our ideology. I'd like to see it spread, although I think our attempts to spread it have often been counterproductive, but still China has always seemed to me extremely pragmatic in its international relations. They just want countries that will do business with them. And I think the threat, and this is really pervasive in Silicon Valley, and I think that's driving a certain amount of the China hawkism now, is the idea that China's goal, like if they win the race to AI, then they will use AI to somehow impose their ideology on us or something.
Right.
And I just think it's a very unexamined assumption that that's the way China wants to do business.
Yeah. I mean, it's you know, first of all, this idea that China is working to infiltrate and weaken the United States, we Americans are weakening our own democracy just fine. Thank you very much. I mean, the idea that, I suppose there's an argument that other powers are working to, you know, kind of accelerate and exacerbate some of these existing tensions. I mean, that's something the United States has always done as well. So that's not to defend it, but that may be going on. But, you know, China didn't create these problems any more than Russia created these problems. It just kind of used tools to kind of exacerbate kind of the political salience of them. But also the big problem now, as I see it politically, is you know, as we mentioned earlier, I mean, we are in a deeply polarized moment, and it's always attractive to politicians and think tankers and other, you know, foreign policy wonks to say, okay, we disagree about so much, but we can have unity on this issue. Right. Mm-hmm. Here's an area of consensus, whether it's the war on terror or now the China threat, you know, and there's this idea, this kind of very attractive, yet I think extremely dangerous notion that we can rebuild the American political compact, the American political consensus around this idea of beating China and winning the future. And I think that's deeply stupid. But it is something that, you know, that appeals to politicians, especially ones who don't spend too much time thinking about foreign policy, which is a lot of them, because it, you know, there's always, you know, when you this whole idea of like, well, I'm strong on foreign policy and this is how I demonstrate it. It's a pretty easy way to sort of put your flag up here in Washington.
So is AI policy getting much attention in the circles you travel in D.C.?
Yeah, I mean, AI has become, you know, very much a thing. It's rare that you can go to a meeting on pretty much any subject and AI doesn't come up. I wouldn't say that means that people have come up with great ideas on how to handle it, because, again, the technology is moving so quickly. You know, and let's just going back a couple months ago, right? We had the announcement of this Chinese AI DeepSeek, and this came after a couple years of extremely restrictive U.S. policies with regard to some of this technology, the theory being, oh, we need to deny these critical technologies to China in order to win, you know, the technological race on a whole range of things, including AI. And then all of a sudden, surprise, surprise, somehow they had managed to develop this domestically. And I think it just shows how kind of futile that approach is. There needs to be some kind of you know, whether it's a non-proliferation approach, some kind of, you know, set of international conventions or agreements to deal with this. I don't think there's any way around that.
Yeah, I've been paying a lot of attention to this issue, and one thing I'm sure of is that, well, two things. One is that it actually is a dangerous technology if we don't govern it wisely. There's a lot of different ways things could go wrong, including just the sheer destabilizing effect of change this rapid affecting this many parts of life. But the other thing I'm sure of is that the worst way to go through this challenge is in a state of deep international conflict, especially between the two AI superpowers.
Right.
There absolutely has to be some agreement on rules of the road, and there has to be some of the kind of natural transparency that happens when there's economic and cultural engagement between two countries and they're on more or less good terms. I mean, I just think we're toast if we don't improve relations with China. I think AI itself should, in principle, move the improvement of relations with China up to the top of the list of foreign policy priorities. Almost no one of consequence seems to feel that way, so far as I can tell. And it's weird, when you talk to the people in AI, a lot of them will accept the thing I said about it being really dangerous to go through this revolution in a state of international strife, because you do need some international coordination. And yet, a lot of them support, like, the chip controls. And when you try to bridge those two things. Oh, here's a good talking point you could get out. As long as you're going to spend the rest of the year going around telling people about my ideas about labor accords and regional trade agreements, there's another point you could throw in, Matt.
Okay.
This is starting to get a little attention, but it's like, and I apologize again to listeners who have had to endure this before. I'm sorry. But It has gotten almost no discussion, maybe a little recently, but these chip controls have been in effect for years and years, and there's one obvious consequence of them, which is that once China is no longer getting advanced AI chips out of those factories, which is our goal, then China has less to lose from the destruction of the factories. And so whatever deterrent effect there had been on any Chinese plans to invade Taiwan is weakened. And increasingly, you know, once Taiwan, in response to these restrictions, develops a robust capacity to at least build all the kinds of chips domestically that are below the very top tier, and they're self-sufficient in that regard, and we're still getting not only those kinds of chips, but the advanced AI chips out of Taiwan, you know, if there is still a sense of conflict between us, then it is positively appealing to China to wipe out the factory and maybe it, in one fell swoop, take Taiwan in the process. The point is, you know, it's just so clear cut, the game theoretical logic here. And yet, if you look at these very smart people who helped usher this chip policy, and like Eric Schmidt, who was one of the prime movers, formerly CEO of Google, like, they never talk about it. So you are going to, can I count on you?
Hold Eric Schmidt to account.
Yeah. Would you, can you get him on speed dial, man?
Yeah. I'm going to push this at the next dinner. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Well,
what can I do
for you? What memes do you want me to spread in Central New Jersey? Because, you know, people think Central New Jersey is just like all Turnpike and everything. There's a lot of political influence here. And if there's something you would like me to get out, my neighbor,
Central Jersey is a sleeping giant. Everyone.
It really is. Yeah. It's the region of tomorrow and always will be. They say about Brazil. So what would you like me? What's your favorite meme? I'm at your disposal.
Your favorite policy meme proposal.
Yeah. What is an underrated thing to say about foreign policy? Something is not getting said enough in anywhere, including Central New Jersey.
I mean, I don't know if it's a meme, but I would just like, we need to reintroduce campaign finance reform as a major plank.
Man.
Yeah. That's a big hill, but we need to start climbing that freaking hill.
Well, like, what about the Supreme Court saying that money is a form of speech?
That's, you know, again, that's part of like this huge mountain. It's added to the pile. But the Supreme Court, I mean, responds to political pressure. Let's have no illusions about that. We need to really just make campaign finance reform a thing again. Because ultimately, if we are serious about, you know, rebuilding and safeguarding our democracy, we need to confront the fact that it is among the most corrupt democracies in the developed world. I mean, the U.S. is a complete outlier in the way that our campaign finance system is run. It's a system of legalized bribery. And we need to start talking about this in much more explicit terms.
Well, and Trump is taking it to a new level and adding whole new dimensions to it. I mean, this is true oligarchy, or at least budding oligarchy. Something. And it's amazing how fast it's become normalized and we've become desensitized to it. I mean, I just read this Washington Post piece about how Elon Musk, like whole countries are giving him Starlink contracts in hopes that like he'll, you know, they'll get something in exchange from the White House. And it's like, this would have been a huge scandal in ordinary times, but it's like, you know, it's ho-hum.
Yeah. But, you know, the joke is not really a joke. It's just like Trump he's just more blatant about this stuff, you know? There's always been this undercurrent of, you know, family of politicians getting cushy jobs. You know, again, I don't listen. Joe Biden's love for his son Hunter is a beautiful thing, but everyone knows why Hunter was on those boards. It's not because he's an energy expert. Okay, let's just be real about it.
Have high energy moments.
He did. Clearly, we unfortunately had to see some of them.
Some were captured on video.
But you know, even just like high ranking officials who kind of cycle in and out of corporate boards, including like defense contractor boards. And then they ask us to believe that they're not going to give these companies favorable treatment. It's absolutely absurd. So yes, Trump and Musk now are being just more blatant about it. You've got Eric and Donnie Jr. traveling the world, making deals for the Trump Organization. They're just, you know, much more open about it, but this is something that unfortunately has gone on and, you know, polite society in Washington kind of pretends it's not too big of a problem. It is a huge problem.
Yeah. What, so you've been very involved in politics, including presidential politics. I mean, you were Bernie's foreign policy advisor during the as he was running for president.
Mm-hmm.
How much hope do you think there is that the Democrats will wisely choose a candidate in at least a minimal sense of like a candidate who can win? Because the thing about Trump is, I don't think there's ever been a year in that he was all that hard to beat inherently. Mm-hmm. I just think there were some super bad candidates that happened to go up against him twice. Even Biden, I think Biden was the strongest of the three, and that's one reason he won, but he wasn't a dream candidate. And, you know, I'm not the first to say this, but, you know, times have changed since nominees were chosen to a large extent by party elites, or at least, you know, they had a lot of influence. And both systems have their virtues, but the pure primary system has evolved to a system where you start out each campaign by putting like a dozen people on stage, half of whom are clowns who are just rich enough to work their way into the crowd.
Yeah.
And they say crazy shit. And, it has not been working out super well, I think, for the Democrats. Mm-hmm. But what do you have any hope?
I always have hope.
The system is going to stay the same, right? The nominating system.
Yes, it is going to stay the same. But I also think, I mean, and this is, you know, this is a really important question. So is it, can the Democrats manage to nominate someone who's good on foreign policy in 2028? Is that what you're asking?
Oh, well, somebody who both would be to our liking, that would be the idea, both to our liking along that dimension, about which both you and I care a lot about, and someone who can beat J.D. Vance or whoever it is.
Right. No, I think the answer is yes. I mean, listen, I wrote, you know, a piece in The Guardian back in January that asked, why have the Democrats essentially become the party of war? It noted that Donald Trump, you know, they abandoned the anti-war lane and enabled Donald Trump to fill that. And I don't take Donald Trump seriously as an anti-war candidate, but I do think it's notable in 2024, as in 2016, he campaigned from the left. And I note this interesting data point is that in every election since the end of the Cold War, every election since 1992, the less hawkish candidate has won, with the one exception of 2004. And John Kerry didn't offer too much of an alternative from George W. Bush at that time. And I think, you know, that's an interesting data set right there. That's not to say that their foreign policy stance was determinative, but I do think it's interesting to note, how does that relate to a whole set of other signals that these candidates are sending? I mean, Joe Biden himself in 2020 ran on ending the forever wars. I would say he went some way in keeping that promise in Afghanistan. He apparently seemed to think that there was one forever war, and it was Afghanistan, instead of kind of the broader global war on terror, which he diminished in some ways, but still kind of waged in kind of this broader pursuit of American primacy. I think it's just convincing, the party establishment or some part of the party establishment that you don't have to keep taking these dumb, hawkish positions to be seen as serious on foreign policy.
Okay. So listen, man, as you know, this podcast, we have an extended discussion that is public, available to everyone. Then we spend a little time in overtime, in which we see the real Matt Duss.
I'm going to take these off.
Begin. Start disrobing. You can start with the glasses, sure. you've been kind enough to stick around for a while. So the overtime is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. There's a link in the show notes. You can click, you can go to the website, and click on this episode, the Non-Zero website. We encourage everyone to stick with us. Before we go into overtime, Matt, anything you want to say about things of yours that people should check out, places they can see your social media stuff, any kind of self-promotion? You're at the Center for International Policy.
Yeah, so check out CIPolicy.org. You can check out my Twitter feed or X feed, whatever, at Matt Duss, also on Blue Sky, and, you know, occasional pieces that I publish in various, you know, family-friendly websites such as Foreign Policy, The New Republic, occasionally The New York Times, and a few others. Okay. And also, I should, of course, I have to mention the podcast Undiplomatic, which I co-host with my good friend Van Jackson and Julia Gledhill. So please do check that out. And I'm glad I didn't forget to mention that. And Van is a fellow at CIP as well. His work is fantastic. People should check out his Substack too.
Yes. He's been on our podcast platform not so long ago.
Yeah.
Okay. So thanks to everybody. We're gonna dig more deeply into the question of whether there's there's hope for the Democratic Party, and for the anti-war movement. I do want to challenge a little bit your characterization of Trump as, well, I guess you called him the less hawkish candidate. Yeah, maybe, but he's got a funny way of being a dove, you know.
I would not call him a dove.
Happy to get into that. Okay. All right. So thanks, everybody. We hope to see you in overtime.